Have you ever heard of face palming? It's typically used as a humorous expression of shock or maybe exasperation at something that strikes you as surprising or more often just idiotic. Just so we're all on the same page here, for a proper face palming, proper procedure here, you start with your hand wide open. You then bring your hand up and your forehead down simultaneously such that your palm smacks audibly on your forehead. This is followed by, again, if you're doing it according to procedure here, slowly moving your hand down the rest of your face as if wiping something off of it, maybe the stupid that you've just seen. Now, the expression has become commonplace enough in our culture that there's a face palm emoji. If you were to do a YouTube search for face palming, you could actually find quite a few entries. I know this because I did it. And I found this little gem from the movie Naked Gun 33 and a third. You can click in the link there in the blog. I'll give you a chance to watch that. Yeah, when the good guy manages to convince the bad guy to give up his gun because, well, psychotic people shouldn't have guns in the first place, the time is right for a good face palming. Because of the nature of the world in which we live and the progress our culture seems to be constantly making down the road of total inanity these days, it sometimes seems that there are face-palm-worthy things going on around us all the time. Now, you might be asking what any of this has to do with our current series, Hard to Love. Connection point is here. Very often, the person or group that prompts a face-palming is, or thereafter becomes, hard to love for us. Well, this morning we are in the fourth part of this journey of looking at the issue of how to deal with people in our lives who are hard to love. The idea that's been guiding us on this journey so far is just that. We all have people in our lives who are hard to love. And like it or not, many of these folks are the people we see and interact with on a daily basis. And so the real challenge for us so far has been that if you're somebody who would identify yourself as a follower of Jesus and you want to live in a manner consistent with that confession, we've got to learn to love these folks, if for no other reason than because God does, and we really don't want to put ourselves in the position of not loving someone for whom Jesus died, right? We love our hard to loves because God does too. Well, after establishing that baseline, we spent the second week of the series looking at how we can become the kind of people who can successfully love the hard-to-loves in our lives, especially when the point of division is our belief about something significant. What we found after reflecting on some of Paul's words to Timothy is that if we will reach out with grace while holding fast to truth, we'll be able to find a productive way forward. Whenever we find we don't agree, grace and truth will help us see. Then last week, we stepped back from theory and looked at all of this in practice through the story of Jesus and the woman at the well and the story of Mary Johnson reaching out with forgiveness to O'Shea Israel, the man who murdered her son. We saw what can happen when we follow through on the love God has for even the hardest to love people in our lives. The results were simply stunning. The whole community of Sychar was transformed when Jesus reached out with love to the unlikeliest of people, a sinful Samaritan woman. In Mary's case, she experienced a restoration of joy, and O'Shea experienced a restoration of hope and life when love was injected into a situation that any of us could have easily imagined remaining hard to love indefinitely. Well, the same kind of thing is entirely possible in our own lives if we will only find ways to reach out with love into our hard-to-love situations. Love transforms even the hardest situations. Well, today, I want to make a bit of a turn with you in all of this. Last week, I told you that the whole purpose of this series is twofold. The first is that we would come to understand how to love the hard-to-loves in our lives. And the second purpose is for us to get our hearts and minds wrapped around the fact that God loves us in spite of the fact that for Him, we are hard to love. I also told you then that it will be when we understand the second part that we'll be able to put that first part into practice. Well, after 3 weeks, we fairly well understand how to love the hard to loves in our lives. But the driving force isn't really there yet because we haven't covered the second part. This week and next, we're going to change that. I told you way back in the first week when giving an overview of kind of where we'd be going, that talking about hard to love people in our lives, we were going to spend some time wrestling with a hard truth. here we are. Over the course of the last 3 weeks, and even again this morning, we mentioned the fact that we could easily fit into the category of hard to love for God. Now, as we've said, we aren't actually hard to love for God since He is love, but the way we've behaved toward Him would leave us all but written off for anybody else. But making this acknowledgement and really wrapping our hearts and minds around it, two different things. Right? Saying we're hard to love for God can easily become one of those cliched phrases we throw around and then forget about in practice, kind of like how the phrase, well, nobody's perfect, is often used to excuse without consequence some decidedly imperfect action on our part. We acknowledge it because it's theologically correct, but then we jump straight on over to God's incredible love and forget almost entirely about the first part. The kick is, while this leap to love is totally understandable, it actually serves to diminish somewhat the wonder of the prize we're seeking. Think about it like this. If I had told you last week that Mary Johnson had reached out with love to O'Shea Israel simply because she was part of a prison ministry that worked to share God's love with inmates, you might have been impressed, but I mean, not all that much. After all, her ministry would have been all about showing love to people like O'Shea, so her coming to love him wouldn't really be very surprising. And besides, he wouldn't have done anything to her in that case. You know, good for her, sure, but let's move on. When I told you that she reached out with love to O'Shea after he murdered her son, well, I heard someone react audibly to that news. That wasn't just good for her, it was absolutely stunning. That kind of love makes our hearts flutter with desire. We want that kind of love. Seeing the love is one thing. Understanding its context, its incredibly difficult and extraordinarily unlikely context at that, that's something else. That doesn't warrant mere kudos. It warrants a celebration. That's a story worth being told. That's why I told it to you. Well, God's love for us is like that. Knowing about it is one thing. Knowing what it came out of, well, that's something else. That's what leads people to receive it. But here's the hard part. Knowing what it came out of isn't pretty. But if we're going to be able to celebrate God's love to the fullest degree possible, it's a picture we have to not simply see, but own. In order to make things at least a little bit easier on us, though, we're going to do this mostly by looking at a story from Israel's past that is definitely worthy of a face-palming. If you'll grab a nearby copy of the scriptures, you can find this story in Exodus chapter 32. And as you find your way there, let me just kind of set the stage for us. When Moses led the people out of Israel out of Egypt, the first place they went, we talked about this a few weeks ago, was to Mount Sinai. We talked about that when we were talking about incorporating the practice of Sabbath in our lives. They went there because God had chosen that to be the location from which he would give them the law. Now, there are a couple of important things to keep in mind about the nation of Israel at this point in history. Number one, to call them a nation is pretty generous because they had no land of their own. Their ancestors had arrived in Egypt about 400 years before this time with a caravan of 70 people. That 70 people had grown to nation size, you know, at least as far as standards back then went, but they'd been slaves for most of the time since then. This leads to the second thing. They've been slaves for decades, generations even. Not a single member of the community had known freedom in their lifetime. None of them. All they had known was doing what somebody else told them. Listen, living that way for any amount of time isn't healthy. Doing it for as long as they've been doing it, that can destroy the character of a people. This group of folks had no idea how to govern themselves and get along without an overlord of some kind. And as a bonus third point, other than their family stories, which for us comprise the book of Genesis, they didn't know who God was, let alone anything about him. Still, though, what they did know by the time they reached Mount Sinai should have been sufficient to have convinced them just how stupid what they were about to do was. They knew he was powerful. They knew he was for them. They knew he loved them. They knew he was concerned with justice. And they knew things didn't go very well for folks who opposed him. They knew all of this when they arrived at the base of Mount Sinai. They didn't know anything else. They at least knew those five things. They knew it when Moses gave them the law. They knew it when they gladly entered into the covenant of law with him. Moses recited to them the basic outline of the law, and the people all together said, yep, sounds good. We will commit to living life that way. More specifically, they said in Exodus 24:7, we will do and obey all that the Lord has commanded. This would have been like the spiritual high of church camp to the nth degree. Well, immediately after this, God called Moses to come up the mountain where God would give him a physical enshrinement of the law on two tablets. These were to serve as a constant reminder for the people of the covenant they voluntarily entered into with God. This, though, is where things went south. You see, Moses, when he went up that mountain, he stayed gone longer than any of the people expected that he would. Yeah, I figured he'd go up, get the tablets, come back down, they can move on. But he didn't. He was gone a week. That wasn't so bad. But then he was gone a second week, and they were starting to get restless. Then he was gone a third week, and folks were starting to wonder openly whether he was ever coming back down the mountain. By week four, they were tired of waiting for their absent leader to return. They wanted to get onto the promised land they'd heard over and over about. But what happens next is detailed for us in Exodus 32. Look at this with me now, starting in verse 1. When the people saw that Moses delayed in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said to him, come, make gods for us who will go before us, because this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. You see what's going on here? Moses was taking too long to come back, and the people were tired of waiting for him. So they went to Aaron, Moses' second in command and brother, and demanded that he make them some gods to lead them onto the promised land. What? How could they do this? I mean, did they not just agree to not do this sort of thing? But look more, though, at how they refer to Moses. This Moses, we don't know where he's gone. This guy who did all these remarkable things for us, he's missing. We're tired of waiting for him. You make a substitute, Aaron, and we'll take it. In other words, within days, okay, weeks, but within days of agreeing to place themselves under the authority of the law and to enter into this covenant with God, they brazenly set out to trample on the very first two commands. And what's even worse, Aaron lets them. Look at this, back in verse 2 now. Aaron replied to them, take off the gold rings that are on the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people took off the gold rings that were on their ears and brought them to Aaron, obedient people. He took the gold from them, fashioned it with an engraving tool, and made it into an image of a calf. Now, pay attention to how that was phrased there. That'll be important in a minute. Then he said, Israel, these are your gods who brought you up from the land of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of it and made an announcement. There will be a festival to the Lord tomorrow. Early the next morning they arose, offered burnt offerings, and presented fellowship offerings. The people sat down to eat and drink and got up to party. And when you hear the word party there, don't think fancy soiree. Think wild, drunken fraternity or sorority bash. Well, just so we're on the same page here, let's review for a minute. God had come to the rescue of his people because of the promises he'd made to their ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, brought them up out of slavery, bringing a pretty severe judgment against the unjust people of Egypt in the process, the most powerful nation in the world at the time, and led them through Moses on the start of a journey that he promised would end in them having a beautiful new land to call their own. Along the way, he had miraculously delivered them from the Egyptian army with a huge bank of fog that came up out of nowhere, and also by dividing an entire sea in half so they could cross it safely on dry ground. He had miraculously provided food and water for them along the journey. He made explicitly clear the path that they were to travel so there wasn't any question on how to get where they were going. He'd promised them incredible blessings. He had given them, a people who were essentially building a culture from scratch, the most just system of laws the world had ever seen to that point in history so they could skip right over the years of trial and error it takes most nations to arrive at such an achievement. All of this, and the only thing he had asked for them was to follow him and nobody else. Now, maybe that sounds like a big ask, But not when you set it alongside all he'd done for him. And how do they respond? By walking away the very first time things got tough. They took all of the gifts God had given them, threw them right back in his face, and reached for whatever they thought to be right. Now, what comes next is at one and the same time tragic, hysterical, and awe-inspiring. The first part is obvious. It's a tragedy that the people would rebel against the very God who would save them on the very first opportunity that presented itself to them. It's a tragedy that Aaron, in spite of all he had seen and heard, as he walked next to Moses and spoke the words of God to Pharaoh, would simply lay down before the people and go along with this insane request. It's a tragedy that the people would bring dishonor to the name of God in the eyes of all the peoples around them who watched them behave so fickly before their God and naturally assumed that, well, theirs was a weak God who could not inspire real devotion from his people. That's all the tragedy here. The comedy comes in the reactions of the various key players. Up on Mount Sinai, God speaks to Moses to let him know what was going on at the mountain's base. Look at this in verse 7. The Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down at once, for your people you brought up from the land of Egypt have acted corruptly. They've quickly turned from the way I commanded them. They made for themselves an image of a calf. They bowed down to it and sacrificed to it and said, 'Israel, these are your gods who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" One of the things Lisa and I will sometimes say to each other in jest, mostly, when one or more of the boys are acting up, is that your children are doing such and such. That's kind of like what God's doing here with Moses. They're like a married couple complaining to each other about the behavior of the kids. Israel was the people of God. He had claimed them for himself. And yet here he cries out to Moses, "Go down there and deal with your people who you brought up out of Egypt." Implication? I would have left them there, but no, you insisted we bring them along. In the next few verses, it looks like Moses essentially talks God down from the destruction he was ready to rain down on the people. The culmination of this, though, is that Moses storms down the mountain, hollers at the people, smashes the tablets that God himself had made for the people to serve as reminders of the covenant they had just made with him, ground up the golden calf and made the people eat it, and finally confronted Aaron. Now, this is the best part. The people reacted like scolded children. But look at what Aaron says in verse 22. "Don't be enraged, my lord," Aaron replied. "You yourself know that the people are intent on evil. They said to me, 'Make gods for us who will go before us,' because this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. So I said to them, 'Well, whoever has gold, take it off.' And they gave it to me. Then I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." Did you catch that? "These evil people backed poor, innocent me into a corner, threatened me. So I said, 'Give me some gold.' And it's the strangest thing, Moses. They gave me all this gold. I just threw it into the fire. And wouldn't you know it? A golden calf popped out. Who'd have thunk it?" Really, Aaron? Really? It's like the people, Aaron included, started to come down from their mountaintop high after ratifying their covenant with God. And instead of, you know, kind of doing it slowly, they found the nearest cliff with a sheer face plunging a mile straight down into the bottom of a narrow ravine and threw themselves over the side lemmings-like. I mean, come on, Aaron! He might as well have told Moses that a dog ate his homework. But really, it was even worse than that. If you're have been through the journey of parenthood, you remember how you felt the last time you did something really good for your kids and they responded with terrible behavior? You remember that Christmas morning, that one time when after you finished cleaning up from Santa and the grandparents that gave you a bunch of lip and started fighting with each other? This is like that times 6 million. And here's the thing. When you read through the scriptures, this isn't the only time it happened. We started down this path of rebellion almost from the moment we came out of the starting gate. God gave us the garden. And we said, "Nah, we'll take the one thing you told us we can't have." God brought Noah and his family through the waters of the flood. The only people saved in the entirety of the world. And his response was to get fall down drunk and embarrass his family first chance he got. God promised Abraham a family, an incredible blessing, and he responded by lying about who his wife was to save his own skin twice. God made David king. And he raped the wife of a good friend and then had the friend murdered. Jesus spent an entire night preparing the disciples for what was about to happen to him in the ordeal of the cross, and they all ran out on him anyway. We even see this still happening just before the end of the world in Revelation. Satan gets locked up in the abyss for 1,000 years, during which time Jesus himself personally rules over the earth. At the end of the 1,000 years, Satan gets let back out and immediately is able to put together a huge army of people who are willing to attack Jesus and his followers. When Paul was laying out the gospel to believers in Rome, it's no wonder he quoted what David himself had written 1,000 years before. There is no one righteous. Not even one. There's no one who understands. There's no one who seeks God. All have turned away. All alike have become just worthless. There's no one who does what is good. Not even one. Are you uncomfortable yet? Let me make it worse for you. Here's where all this is going. When it comes to God, we are hard to love. We may have hard to love people in our lives. In fact, let's just say that all of us do have hard to love people in our lives. But this is nothing in comparison with how hard to love we are to God. We are hard to love. We have been ever since the moment that Adam didn't bother to say to Eve, honey, maybe we shouldn't eat the fruit since God said not to. We're hard to love. Think about it. God created us. He gave us life. He pours out blessings on everybody. If you've ever seen a beautiful sunset or listened to the pitter-patter of a late summer's rainstorm or felt the gentle breeze of an early spring morning or smelled the savory aromas of fall or taken in a full, deep, and refreshing breath of air or nestled in the arms of someone who loves you or experienced the satisfaction of a job well done or basked in the glow of a child's smile of delight or any one of a billion other things, you've experienced the blessings of your Heavenly Father. But if you've ever once done something you knew in your heart you shouldn't have done, said something you shouldn't have said, thought something you shouldn't have thought, then you've thrown all of that back in his face and said, you can shove your blessings. I'll take my own way. If I were a betting man, I'd bet the house that you've done that more than once. Because I have too. We are hard to love. We are the objects of a cosmic, divine face-palming. What's more, we follow in Aaron's pattern of making stupid, whiny excuses to try and cover for it. We are hard to love. But that's not how the story ends. We may be hard to love, but God loved us anyway. And if you'll come back for one more week of the series, we're going to celebrate that fact like crazy.